Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. 4, 3, 2, and 1. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards, and alongside me today, ladies and gentlemen, we have Ivantika Dang, co-founding partner at Plum Alley Ventures Company. Ivantika, all the way from New York City. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Kevin. Really appreciate it. And I love the way you say New York City.
It's a beautiful place, the Big Apple. One of the things that, I think just to share with the audience here, kind of before the show, as a New Yorker would, running around, going from place to place, always fast paced, always moving. And you told me, you said, a lot of people say we're in a downturn, but the deals are still continuing to flow. In your line of business, it's very cyclical. Tell me a bit about the entrepreneurial mindset you need to have to be creative in this kind of environment today.
Yeah, absolutely. Pun intended, I'm still in my running clothes because from my run this morning, I haven't had a break. Within the meetings and different operational tasks at the office. But the venture market, to answering your question, has seen a low coming in to the end of last year, 2023, like it's never experienced. Global venture markets are at its lowest points in 6 years. The US venture market in the venture industries, lowest since 5 years. Often enough, when we go through ebbs and flows of cycles like this, I often refer to them and label them, as we all do, being American, gotta label everything. I refer to them as compressed markets, right? Or situational markets, be it COVID, or compressed markets because of financial considerations, high interest rate, capital's not freely available like it was for the last few years in venture, creating frothy valuations and essentially creating problems for itself that we were feeding into. The flip of that is the opportunity it creates. And what it does is that it creates what I refer to as a builder's market or a builder's mentality. And that serves two people on both sides of the stakeholders. So from an entrepreneurial perspective, what it does is that it allows for a washout to happen. So those that cannot operate their business without leaning into capital, essentially, basically, identifying a lot of problems right in that, which is if your business can't stand without investors' capital, something's really wrong. Investors' capital should be a fuel, but not necessarily the business or the entire toolkit. And so you have a washout, and it washes out and it clears out the playing field for those that can continue to operate either because their business unit economics continues to make sense, either because the product or the business or the operations are needed by users, customers, clients, or because they have been prudent to ensure that the capital in the bank to support them supersedes their needs. And so either one of these three things or all three things allow for those that continue to have a very much a historic builder's mentality on how they've built, or the ability to hanker down and create that builder's mentality if they're in that third segment of the bucket. What I appreciate from an entrepreneur's mentality is in markets or adjustment markets like this, compressed markets, situational markets, the washout that creates, right? So it clears out a lot of the noise, a lot of the FOMO, that's real in the venture industry, which, you know, I have a lot of problems with, which is why we do what we do. And I'm sure we'll touch on that. But for folks like me who are operators converted into venture, we very much appreciate the tightening of the belt here, which brings us to reality rather than frothy ways of how venture has operated historically. On the flip side, on the investor side, compressed markets, situational markets, do two things there as well. One is a different kind of washout. It washes out those investors that don't have conviction in their investment thesis, that don't have the muscle power of truly understanding how venture investments should work and should operate, right? So again, it cleans out a lot of that noise. And a lot of that noise comes in when there's a lot of excitement. Again, a different version of FOMO that comes in from an investor side. And then the second thing it does from an investor perspective, as you look at situational markets or compressed markets, is that investors start asking different questions. And that's where the conviction comes in. Of course, you know, the negative of that is that it becomes a investor market where investors become, in some cases, vultures and take too much skin off the entrepreneur's back. But, you know, and again, I would question if those are real VCs. VCs are in the business. They are who they are because of the entrepreneurs. And so taking too much skin off the back that is not a VC that's in it for long term or truly respects what venture as a industry is all about. But the questions that real investors start asking in markets, adjustment markets like this, is getting down to the book of business. And again, as an operator for over 28 years converted into venture, I very much appreciate that level of sophistication and that level of intellect and the seriousness of operation that comes in to adjustment markets like we've experienced, right? So your question about activity levels, the market's down 30%, 40%, depending on within venture, if you're looking at global or US. At Plum Alley Ventures Company, you know, we experienced similar levels of reduction in our total capital deployment. But what hasn't changed for us is the activity level in terms of the number of deals we're doing. For example, 2024, we're on our third deal already of the year. And so number of deals have continued to stay high in terms of activity, partly because of reinvestment into existing portfolio companies, partly because of investments into new companies. But where we did feel the pinch, but a different level of activity in terms of the seriousness of digging down into diligence was on the capital side, which is, you know, our ticket sizes did reduce pretty much on par with what the industry level was.
And I want to go and really focus on that a little bit more, because I want to hear from your pitch perspective and your side and how you're raising capital. Because of course, you know, the entrepreneurs are going to continue to keep coming, and I'm hearing that as well. But the challenge was, right, in this bidder's market, as you say, the suppressed market, was raising the capital itself. And so, you know, whether it's you, me, we're all constantly pitching our businesses, right? We're constantly pitching ourselves. You know, but what in this bidder's market has been effective for you? And you said the questions changed. Like, what did you change, if you did, in a bidder's market to obtain the capital to then have the ability to deploy it, as you mentioned earlier this year?
Yeah, great question. And thank you for asking that. Personally, I love it. When people say, oh, it's a tough market to raise, you can raise in any market. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but you can raise in any market if you have value. Either you have value for who you are as a leader, as an entrepreneur, as an investor, as a venture capitalist, or you have value, you know, as a builder, as a product, as a technology. So I get a personal high when folks get cold feet and react to markets as they go through cyclical timeframes, right? And I'm constantly referring to this as a compressed market because of capital is not easily available, but it's still out there, right? Like you're looking at, on the VC side, over 300 billion, I think it was 302 billion in dry powder that's available. So depending on where you are and who you are in terms of pitching and fundraising, the capital's out there. If you've got value to show, in fact, now is a better time to be raising because people are asking very serious questions. If you've got a value proposition that's very thoughtful, strategic, has very clear deliverables, a track record, a very clear offering to investors, you actually win because you stand out from the pack. And then if you've got the muscle, you know, and the gut and the conviction to go out when everyone else is pausing, the playing field is yours, right? Like which soccer player takes a ball and then decides to go the other way, right? It doesn't matter. You're playing a game, you're in the game and you're in it right till the last minute. So I actually get really excited about this, partly because of the conviction I have in what we do. And so let me just, you know, take a moment to reflect on that.
Yeah.
Coming in, you know, Plum Alley, we've been investing since 2017 with a very unique thesis. I call ourselves the geekiest investors in town. We invest in frontier technologies, deep tech and medical breakthroughs. Lots of arguments with my co-investors and friends, you know, they say, oh, we're moonshot. No, we're not moonshot. We're frontier tech, which is bleeding edge into leading edge. So as operators, you know, my partner, Deborah Jackson and I, we're both operators for close to three decades. She spent time on Wall Street. I spend time operating in the two industries we invest in, on the deep tech side, as well as the medical breakthrough side, with a few notables, having crossed all four sides of the table, including building companies, products, technologies, IPOs, failed startups, successful startups, raising capital, M&A, some of the two largest M&As that were done in the industry, I was a commercial lead of. So a lot of wealth and depth, breadth of experience that Deborah and I bring to the table. We decided that in venture, we wanted to solve for the hardest problems. And that meant putting capital behind the hardest technologies. Back in 2016, 2017, that was known as hardware. Well, since then, you know, hardware is not so hard anymore. And so we've evolved to call it frontier technologies, deep tech, and medical breakthroughs. We then take our investment thesis. We've deployed now coming in over 100 million across 32 companies. But that wasn't just meaningful enough for us, right? And we're solving for essential problems of the world, such as understanding electrification, automation, the use of robotics, not just in terms of arms, but serious use of robotics, such as front lines in hospitals, being assistants to nurses. So when COVID happened, guess what? These robots were out there, not just protecting the nurses, but also serving the patients. But, you know, and that's really beautiful and it creates a lot of empathy, but we do it with understanding what does the unit economics application look like for a customer, for an enterprise, that an industry that needs to be future-proofed because they're legacy industries, applying these frontier technologies to it. So I went into a little bit of detail here because to express and underscore that what we do as an investment thesis is hard. But that wasn't enough for Deborah and I. We wanted to make it more intentional. And so we took our investment thesis and we layered it over a gender mandate. So 100% of our capital that's been deployed until end of last year has been across gender diverse founding teams, female-founded, co-founded teams, essentially. And so we created a very specific investment thesis, a very specific portfolio, which now has come into the limelight because we've got a couple of companies that are unicorn status. They got a unicorn status before they publicly announced billions of dollars in contract value. In that, you know, what we wanted to show was the realism, the excitement, and the tangibility that excites us in our conviction in what we do, and not really being worried about whether it's the right market to invest in or the wrong market to invest in, because these unicorn companies have billions of dollars of contracts to justify and support them. Very hard to see, and they're few and far between where VCs can stand up and say, yes, you know, we've got portfolio companies where their billions in valuations are actually overjustified by real revenue, real customers, and real tangibility in their business model. We can, because we approached it from a very different perspective, right? And we really started out from a bottoms-up perspective on understanding the technologies that need to exist in the world to solve for what we refer to as future-proofing problems. So not just what needs to happen today, but what needs to happen within the next decade. And then how does that birth the next ecosystem of innovation there beyond? So that's how we closed out 2023. And where some of my earlier excitement that I leverage comes in is we use 2022 and 2023 to also further develop our strategy and our platform coming into 2024. And so we ourselves as VCs used last year as a builder's market for ourselves. Yeah, it's being a VC, you know, you can deploy capital through dedicated pools of capital, AKA funds, 2N20 structures. You can deploy capitals through SPVs, doing direct investments. You know, last year we saw a lot of favoritism towards directs from institutions, family offices, and individuals. We started with a multi-strategy platform. So we actually started with SPVs. We've done 70 SPVs at Plum Alley. When COVID happened, was the first time we actually put our first fund in place. We raised a fund in less than 3 years. Sub $25 million first fund, we were fully deployed coming into end of last year. So within 3 years, we raised a fund and we were fully deployed. And that's when we paused and we realized our own magic of having a multi-strategy platform where our SPVs, our direct investments, were giving us line of sight to risers. And we very conveniently went and picked the best of the best of our SPVs that were meeting their KPIs, essentially the risers, and we put them into the portfolio of our fund, and which is why we were able to have the success of rapid full deployment. And then we paused and we said, well, what do we want 2024 and the next decade to look like? And this is where the excitement of our expansion of our growth strategy comes in, which is we're deploying meaningful capital referred to as economic transformative capital of over $1 billion in the next 5 years on a multi-strategy platform, where we solve for a lot of single point failures in venture, essentially addressing a lot of issues that we see in the fund industry. And so our expansion now includes underlying funds that are organized strategically by sector and stage. So if you think through a capital stack from a strategic perspective, which, by the way, venture never does. Venture is not a strategic industry. Separate question, maybe another conversation as to why venture even exists, not being strategic. There are a lot of leaky bucket syndromes because investors always come in with a mindset of stage. So they write one check or two checks, and then they're out. Well, that's not strategy. If you have conviction, you need to understand how to protect your capital, how to play the mathematical game of ownership, and more importantly, how do you ride the stack through wealth creation defined as at IPO. And so now Plum Alley Ventures Company, which is our growth strategy, is very keenly focused on furthering and solving for a lot of fund industry problems that exist in venture for things, you know, everything from lack of strategy down to the economics of GPs, down to layering emerging manager programs, which has become quite the hot topic. First-time fund managers, diverse fund managers, emerging manager fund, emerging manager programs, all very helpful. I'm glad there's been a lot of focus, attention towards it, but nobody is doing it right. And so where the gap is in is the intent and the narrative of people leaning in, but not fully understanding the mathematical model that needs to exist to solve it. So what we're doing
Jump in here, Avantika. And thanks for giving like an overview of the business and kind of strategy. So with this gap, I always think, you know, the impact gap is, you know, your intention, what you're saying you're going to do minus your actions equals the gap, right? Like that is exactly what's happening. Tell me a little bit more. So I ask you, you know, a question around pitching, right? So with all the pitching experience that you've had, all of the entrepreneurs that pitch to you, what are some of those nuggets? What are some of those things when it comes to the economics that you talk about that maybe you're looking for anyone listening to this episode that you can share with them that they can walk away and say, hey, this might help me raise capital or pitch my business to another investor?
Yeah, I think it needs to come down to numbers and understanding how you can make the narrative come out of your numbers, right? And it may be super hard to do if you're a pre-revenue, pre-seed company, but I think you can still lean in on your technology. So I really believe that the right place to start to make it impactful as well as to have the right kind of yield come back to you is the why. Like, where's the value proposition? And often enough, that begins with numbers. I like to hear in pitches that entrepreneurs get to the KPIs, either KPIs that they can show, which in itself explains the value, versus where entrepreneurs tend to go in a chronological order of pitching with explaining how big the market is for the problem that they're solving for. I think as an investor, what I want to understand very clearly is how far have you risen, right? So that whole riser strategy of KPIs and mentality. Again, it may not be possible depending on the stage you're in, but if it's not about understanding how many customers you've had or, you know, your recurring revenue and the conviction I should lean into, which part of it is sticky and which part of it is recurring, then I need to lean in on the tech side, on the IP and the patents, without which, you know, it's not for us. At Plum Alley, we like asset ownership. We like to take risks on hardware. We like to understand if it's not hardware on the software side, what does the IP strategy look like? And part of it is because of how we invest. You know, VC is all about the upside. We also look at the downside and we want to protect our investors, our member investors and our LP investors' capital by understanding that when you do have an asset ownership investment thesis, you're de-risking it by, you know, at least hoping that on the downside, you can still return investor capital.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the successful women entrepreneurs, you know, they'll see, you know, 2% that number, right? It's like all the capital in the world, only 2% of it gets deployed, under 2% gets deployed to female-owned businesses and founders. And a lot of these successful founders, they see it as an opportunity. And they'll go and approach, you know, investors like you, and they know, you know, that they can try and, you know, get this capital. Tell me in your experience,
well,
though.
No, and that's a real, it's a pet peeve moment. So if I can just interrupt where you were going with that question, if that's okay, Kevin. The 2% you mentioned, yes, that's overall capital that goes into female founders. Yeah, you have to give credit to the venture ecosystem, you know, National Venture Capital Association and all VCs around that did lean in over years ago. You know, it was a long time coming, but better late than never. That did change that math. And where the math changed is what we're trying to solve for. And so I'm going to just break it down for you. So early stage, seed stage coming into Series A, actually saw 25% of distribution of capital going into gender diverse founding teams. So female founded teams, but also female co-founded teams, right? So any diverse team. So we saw a meaningful shift in that capital deployment, which is encouraging. What matters to folks like us that are investing with a strategic mindset up the capital stack, especially in frontier tech, is understanding what happens after that, right? Because let's be honest, that it's important to change that early number, but your success rate also changes, right? So, you know, of course you'd want the pre-seed, seed and Series A number of capital diversification to be the hardest, but that's not where the rubber meets the road. The rubber meets the road on what happens after that. So when you're looking at Series B, Series C, D, E, pre-IPO, IPO, and that's where it gets horrifyingly anemic, where I'm going to, and here's the reason why I interrupted you, Kevin, is if you go up the capital stack to where it matters, which is wealth creation defined as IPO, defined as tech companies going public outside of generational wealth, which is majority of the wealth in the US, greater majority in globally. So if it's not generational wealth, it comes through tech companies going public, highest yield. Guess what? Since 2013, so for the last decade, less than 0.8% of companies that have gone public in the US on NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange have had a female founder or a female co-founder or a female CEO. Less than 0.8% per year. Okay. Now, it's not a gender story. I'm a capitalist, right? The reason it matters is diversification of wealth. My educational background is also in economic development. And here's where the 2 points join about me being a capitalist and my academic background. My thesis was in the widening gender gap, the negative impact of economic development leading to a widening gender pay gap. Most people think economic development is good. Again, it always comes down to strategy. The reason this matters is 15, 20 years down the road, you've got a new stakeholder, and that's the minority that's going to be the majority in the population. Right? You've got a new stakeholder coming up. You've got a financial industry that's not addressing this new stakeholder. You've got wealth creation that's not diversified. You've got now not 3 trillion, but 6 trillion of wealth transformation happening to this new stakeholder that's rising over a 15, 20 year period. That is where the problem sits. And it is such a wide quantum of problem. It is also such a wide problem from a sociographic perspective, psychographic perspective, because there's going to be a new set of intentionality-driven questions. And it's not going to be ESG, and it's not going to be somebody screaming about climate, but it's going to be about intentionality. Why does it matter? Is this investment I'm making in this company doing the right thing by labor laws? Are they making sure that the right people are getting paid? Are you ensuring that this technology is doing the right things, right? So intentionality is going to become the precedent and the leading set of questions that's going to be asked by this new stakeholder, right? Which is why diversifying wealth creation becomes instrumental in how we look at the next decade.
Yeah, and just to be clear on what I'm saying, first and foremost, I agree with partially everything you're saying. the one thing I guess I have a question on is intentionality to me was in the growth market. And I think everything you're telling me right now, bidders market, compressed market, data, unit economics, that doesn't really necessarily tell me that's all about intentionality. That tells me that's all about action. That's all about actual economics. That's about a math equation. And you want people going to that math equation first, as opposed to intentionality. How has that shifted?
Yeah, I think, and I'm thank you for bringing that up because it's important. I think it's the nuances are in the definition of intentionality. You're right. In a bull market, you actually have a lot of impact-driven investors that come in. So difference between impact and impact investors and intentionality and intentional investing, right? Very big difference.
Okay. Yeah.
And we're very conscious of it because of how we invest and our investment thesis layered on a gender mandate. We absolutely don't want to be put in a cubbyhole. If Deborah were here, she would say the pink ghetto, right? We don't, which is why we went with the geekiest investment thesis and built a fantastic track record on that because we wanted to move away from it, right? And just because we're two women who are investing on a extremely deep tech thesis on a gender mandate doesn't mean we invest behind every woman. We don't do consumer tech, right? So we absolutely don't touch consumer tech. In fact, when female founders and entrepreneurs, to an earlier question of yours, approaches us, we often look to see if they've done their homework. Because if you've got a Salesforce API layer, you shouldn't be coming to us. If you've got a retail-driven consumer media tech app, you shouldn't be coming to us, right? So the fact that you think just because we're women GPs and that we're approachable, that's a misnomer. You should do your homework, just like every VC says, please go to the website, see what's there, do your homework before you approach us. But anyway, coming back to your point about intentionality, it's in the definition. It means something very different than impact. And I think intentionality does become a lot clearer and more important in compressed markets because it's no different than unit economics. Numbers are intentionality, right? So if you're intending to raise more capital, what do you have to show for that? If capital is compressed and you have to make a specific choice of putting less money in a deal or saying no to five more deals because you've got limited capital to deploy or you're being more conservative, intentionality becomes even more important. And for us at Plum Alley, that means that is this the type of technology we want to go forward with? So, you know, space tech, we're waiting on. But robotics are being applied in industries for automation, logistics, future-proofing. We will continue to lead in because our intention is that this is the right type of technology that needs to continue to exist in the world.
Understood. Yeah. And you know, my statement is solely trying to back the hardworking female entrepreneurs who know it's difficult to raise money in any market, especially in this market. And not to think that this money comes lightly just because you are, you know, focused on, you know, female owned or a female to have a board member who is a female, right? Yeah. That is the clear kind of intention point. I just want to back up the females who are out there struggling, grinding, working day in, day out, and also aren't making excuses as well. Because there's a narrative out there that, oh, just because you're investing in just females, it's just given. No, that's not the case at all. So I just want to get that clear.
And it's not just females. I mean, all entrepreneurs are grinding, right? So you talked about pitching. I run with a group called Pitch and Run. And we have been doing this for many years and everyone's, you know, pitching something to your point. And sometimes it's a real pitch from an entrepreneur to a bunch of us as investors. And sometimes it's just us investors, you know, pitching our platform to others. And sometimes it's just about pitching ideas and strategy. And, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about there is that we should be all very conscious in not singling or labeling subgroups to say, oh, it's really difficult for them. Entrepreneurship is hard. period. It doesn't matter if you're a female entrepreneur or a male entrepreneur. Yes, historically, capital distribution has not favored certain subcategories of entrepreneurs. And, you know, one needs to be conscious of that and, you know, fix it for the right reasons. But again, hard as it is, if you've got the right numbers, metrics to back it, the right technology or the right value proposition, you will find a way. Not to say it makes it any easier, but if there's a value proposition and you, you know, just simply said, you got a buyer and seller, the supply and demands, the lines meet. It may meet at different points, and that's where the difficulty comes in, but it's not that those lines run parallel. They do run parallel if you've got a mismatch between the supply and demand.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And yeah, again, never generalizing here. That's, we never want to do that. Nothing's ever, you know, a silver bullet, as you know. It seems to be, though, that, you know, in a market like this, a lot of creative financing is going on. You know, a lot of collaboration is going on as well. What are some of the innovative techniques or strategies that entrepreneurs you're investing in are using to attract capital in this difficult market?
For us, it's actually an easier question to answer, which is we lean so heavily on the technology and the IP stack. And so that being the foundation actually makes it easier to make the capital deployment decision, right? Like, so the more serious the IP is, the more protected the IP is, the more broader in the sense, the more IP there is, the easier it makes the investment decision towards capital deployment. And then for us, it's also about understanding, because of where we sit, we're Series A and later up the capital stack investors, we really look for that customer tangibility. So, you know, has there been real business that's been conducted here? Are there real customers here paying real money and creating real revenue for a business that can continue to exist? The understanding that there'll always be twists and turns, and which is why we very much appreciate our conviction in our investment thesis, because it solves for a lot of these considerations, you know, that you mentioned. I will say the flip of it, you know, your point about creative financing, that's what we're trying to do. You know, we've become entrepreneurs ourselves, Deborah and I, coming into this year, because we are launching a platform, or we've already launched a platform that does bring a lot of that creativity and collaboration in, right? And just to further what where I was getting a little long-winded on, just by due passion, is that on one side of our multi-strategy, we're continuing to doing directs, which has become of in greater favor by our family offices and our institutional investors, but also individuals, because we create a lot of diversity of investors coming to the table, investing in diverse founders. So it's a very crisp, clear narrative. You know, we've been doing that for 7 years. We built a lot of the product and plumbing behind on the infrastructure. So it's a flywheel for us. As we look at the other side of our strategy, we're building out a slew of dedicated funds that are organized by sector and stage. And this is where the creative financing comes in, where we've said, you know, gone are the days where you just GPs go from fund one to fund two to fund three. You know, they didn't figure out what problems they needed to solve for fund one, which is why they said, oh, let's do a growth fund. Let's do an opportunity fund. We've been very thoughtful, 2 years in the making, where we are inviting GPs that have industry expertise and a domain expert in what they do. So we've launched our early stage climate fund. We're going to follow through with a late stage climate fund. Our GP in our early stage climate fund comes to us with 20 years of domain industry expertise, as well as a track record, right? So we're solving for many nuances in the venture industry where the dots have not been put together. And we're running it like a business, like a real business, right? So we've identified that we need about 10 funds in place over time, you know, through a product rollout, We're launching a few sector-oriented funds, three sectors to be specific, early stage, so you don't have stage drift, which is another problem that, you know, VCs face with the LP investors. More importantly, we're making sure that the right GPs are in the seat, eliminating a lot of the FOMO and smoke and mirrors. These GPs come with track records, they're domain experts, they know what they know in the industry. And so they create a career. They don't have stage drift. A GP doesn't go from early stage to pre-IPO or opportunity just because they need to manage issues of the fund industry, because that's the only way it forward has occurred on a 2-in-20 model. And that's the only way LPs know how to invest after fund one and fund two. And so putting all of these dots in a platform allow us to really operate it like a business, right? So you've got, in this case, a climate fund that's early stage. The GP will only be doing early stage climate funds, right? Not late stage. Then you've got the riser strategy rising to your late stage climate fund. The two GPs of that late stage climate fund that come from industry with expertise will be running a career of only doing late stage climate, right? So, and so we scaffold leadership and GPs and talent into the seats to allow them to run careers and do what they know how to do best, by solving for strategically owning the capital stack all the way to liquidity for investors, right? Nobody solved that for investors, and the poor investors have to constantly solve for it themselves by investing in one fund after another, after another. And then in this business-minded strategic approach, we also solve for diversification of capital deployment with the line of sight that it's a collaborative approach with diversified talents coming to the table, that investing in diversified founders and technologies, creating the outcome being the diversified wealth creation at liquidity. But in that, also giving investors diversified returns all on a single platform.
Makes a lot of sense. And I guess in closing today, just look at the time here, Ivanika, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Like, what is like the one skill set, would you say, that the forward-looking or the next-gen investor needs to have in order to survive? I think that's kind of a common thread throughout this conversation today. What is that skill set, would you say?
Track record. You got to build it. Got to put your time in.
I love that. For Ivanika Dang, I'm Kevin Edwards, asking you out there, build the track record, folks. And always, keep it
running. Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye for now.
Hey, Relators, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to Relators.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.